All right, welcome to Lecture 63 in this American History program of History at Our House. We are continuing with the story of the founding era. And just a reminder here, we have a certain kind of schedule and certain objectives to meet. And so this is our last lecture of this week because it's a short week. And then, of course, we have History Through Art tomorrow. And so then when we come back after our February break, then we'll have one more lecture of new material on this topic, the founding era. And that will be prior to the test. So when we come back, it's going to be a test week. And so we've got to get to the heart of this era. The thing that is distinctive and crucially still present-centrically important about the founding era. We haven't quite gotten there yet. We're very close. I mean, we've been looking at, yesterday we looked at the Bill of Rights, which is the most important event, if you will, or thing that was created during the founding era, single thing that was created during the founding era, in defense of individual rights by the founders. But the period of the founding era has a broader significance in American history. The period of the founding era is the period during which time the founding fathers served as leaders of the nation. That's why I call it the founding era. The period during which the founding fathers served as its leaders, including as its presidents. And that lasted all the way until 1825. And during that time, the founders encountered one particular overarching difficulty in keeping their promise to Americans. One particular challenge above all to individual rights. That's what we're going to look at today is, what was that danger? A danger that they didn't understand. Well, I wouldn't say they didn't understand it well. What's the right way to put it? A danger that they found in practice was the most crucial thing in their particular time. So we'll get to that. And so we've already dealt with, what is that danger? Okay, so we've already dealt with this danger that they anticipated, which was that the American government itself would endanger the rights of its citizens. So that was what this was all about, right? And so we talked about these amendments to the Constitution, these additions to the Constitution, all of which have a peculiar kind of a keyword in them. And I'll help you to find the key word here. It's a tiny word. It's either the word no or the word not. The word no or the word not. Over and over and over again. Why is that? Let's just review this point briefly for a moment before we get to the danger that is at the heart of the founding era. Why is that such a crucial word throughout the amendments to the Constitution? No, not, no, not. What's the essence of this? I'm very surprised. What were the amendments about? What did they say? Generally speaking, Juliet.
They stopped the government from doing things that would hinder or sort of stop people having their individual rights.
Exactly. Right, exactly. So the amendments are restrictions on the power of government. That's why the word no and not is so important to each amendment. Each amendment is a negation of the power of government. That is what is so amazing about the Bill of Rights. It's so rare to see in history anybody in a government that puts restrictions on what the government can do rather than claims power for the government. This is what is so staggering about this Bill of Rights as not just a symbolic, but a really practical and deeply significant set of rules limiting the power of the government. This was the proof of the intent of the Founding Fathers that their purpose was to protect rights. And it was good to have a constitution to unify the states to do that, because otherwise there would be anarchy, and history shows that anarchy is the worst state of affairs for human beings. However, the second worst state of affairs is nobody have a word for it? Worst state of affairs for human beings is anarchy. No government. Nobody to protect their rights. Just a war of all against all. A state of nature, basically. A life that is nasty, brutish, and short. Which is why there isn't a single culture in the history of the world that has a history of all the wonderful accomplishments of that culture during periods of anarchy. Which is why we look at the Dark Ages in European history with such sadness, and other times in history have these horrible qualities. That's anarchy. It's the worst possible thing. But what's second worst? Which is what this whole Bill of Rights is about. What's the second worst thing? Juliet?
Government.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to use that one word. A certain kind. What's the word for that kind, Juliet?
Monarchy.
Well, you see, even monarchy, not necessarily the worst, right? Because you've got a constitutional monarchy. What kind of monarchy? Or any other form, for instance, because communism isn't monarchy, Nazism isn't monarchy, but nonetheless they are, well, Nazism is close to monarchy, but nonetheless they are a certain form of something. Timothy?
Dictatorship?
Too general, okay, I'll give you the word. Tyranny! The worst kind of government is a tyrannical government. There's lots of different kinds. Bria, what's your confusion? What's going on here? How come I can't unmute you? Unmute yourself and let me know what's going on. There we go. All right, what's the confusion? What's the concern? Oh, I see. Okay, good. So, anarchy worst, tyranny second worst. And then, of course, you can gradations going up, and there's many different forms of tyranny. But basically, what they all have in common, I mean, what's the common denominator is that the individual's rights are oppressed by an organized government. Whether that happens to have a king at the top or whether it's a democracy, for that matter, none of it doesn't matter because you don't have your rights. That's the thing. And so that's almost as bad as anarchy. But it's not as bad because we can see that human beings actually can adapt themselves to oppressive governments and still survive. And we have examples of them in history. They do very badly and it's not good, but it's still better than anarchy. And but anyway, to be avoided. Tyranny was to be avoided here. So this is what the amendments are about. And did anybody get a chance to watch the video on the Fifth Amendment, which was such a beautiful presentation by a legal professor? So what was he explaining to people about the Fifth Amendment? People have a certain perception of it. People think that the Fifth Amendment is something that guilty people use to get away with being guilty. And that is just an absurd, perverse interpretation of the Fifth Amendment. What did you get out of it, Timothy?
I got out of it that the Fifth Amendment is used to protect you from saying something that normally would be completely innocent, but someone can interpret it wrong and then criticize you of something, and then you can be accused of something that you did not do or convicted of something that you did not do.
Right, right. The Fifth Amendment is there to protect you from the danger that arises just through the use of words to your rights. And that's what the whole seminar was about, was understanding the importance of your conduct in society with regard to your rights. And when things that you say can harm you. And so that's why the Fifth Amendment is there, to allow you to not hurt yourself, to not be your own worst enemy to your rights. And that's especially true in modern times, when we have an absolutely incalculably large number of laws. There was a hilarious example, right, in the presentation about the laws pertaining to fish and wildlife, including other countries. And so you can, and he gave an example of somebody that was imprisoned because of that, convicted of a crime that he couldn't possibly have known the laws. Had he not spoken about it, he'd be okay. So amazing. So anyway, if you haven't seen it yet, go and pay attention to it, and maybe talk about it in your household and in your family. Because amazing things in modern day America, there are a lot of conflicts in the culture right now. And one of them, which is very sad, is people's relationship to the police. And we've seen examples recently of issues where the police are getting a really bad rap, and in some cases deserve it, I think. And there are challenges here in interpreting what's going on. But we do see in modern America a growing trend, which is pretty scary, of a bad relationship between the people and the police. And so if that's the case, you really need to know your Fifth Amendment as an American citizen. You need to know how to respectfully deal with the police in a manner that is also protective of your rights. You know, for instance, there were kids who were shoveling snow. Remember those snowstorms up in Massachusetts and so on? Right? There were kids that were shoveling snow, and the police ordered them not to shovel other people's snow. They weren't allowed to go to other people's houses and ask them if they wanted to, if they could get $5, $10, whatever, to shovel other people's snow. Because there was a new law out that said you're not allowed to do that, which is a sad and ridiculous law. But every once in a while, funny things, I mean, they're kind of funny, but also sad. You know, there are times when if you're a child and you want to have a lemonade stand, your parents might get arrested and so on. I mean, terrible things like that, that you hear about them and you just shake your head and you're like, how can this be in the land of the free? But sometimes it is. And in that context, it's really crucial to know your rights and to not be afraid at all of, in any circumstances where you get in a difficult situation involving the police, that you don't say anything, that you respectfully assert your Fifth Amendment right And then if there's any help that you can offer them or something important that you need to say to the police, you say it through a lawyer. It gets said properly in a way that doesn't put you at risk. So yeah, I think that presentation is a must see. It's been 5 million views on it, but I think it's a must see for all Americans, and it's a must understand for all Americans. So, and it's great. Imagine that. It's back there in the Fifth Amendment. The founding fathers put it in there. It was ingenious. And there's so much about what the founders did that was ingenious. It's just hard to imagine here. But for the moment, what I want to do is take up a little bit of a different sequence to our work. Typically, when we do this, I do it at the beginning of class, and then we get it out of the way. But I want to go back to this one. I want to go back to the number one restriction on government, according to the founders. The number one, the most important one. The separation of church and state. The removal of all use of force from religion. And of course, the connection for us there is in the history that we've been studying is back here again. So I'm trying to get you guys ready to write this, an explanation of what the Reformation and religious wars was and why and what its most important milestones are in American history. And we've already found three of them. We've already found that we wouldn't understand the Reformation and we wouldn't understand its impact on American history without these three milestones. But where we left off the other day was that these are not enough. We need something else. If this is all you're thinking of when it comes to the Reformation and religious wars, you have got an incomplete thought. And you will not understand why the separation of church and state is so important. So we have to we need another anchor. We need some more information here as a part of our period. And so what is it? What do we need in order to slot this into American history? What do we need about the Reformation that makes it a part of American history? That's the question. And that helps us to understand that First Amendment that we've been looking at. And the essence of the meaning of that. Let me put it to you guys this way. These three facts tell us about religious differences. Is that what the Fifth Amendment is about? Or the First Amendment, pardon me. Is it about religious differences? What do you think? Come on, you got to be able to take this on. Even if you don't know the answer, you got to be able to take a shot at it. Alexander, is it about religious differences?
Well, it is about different religions.
Okay, and you want to make a distinction between different religions and religious differences. Are different religions religiously different?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. So it's about religious differences. Okay. And because would you need to have a First Amendment if everybody agreed to the same religion?
No.
No, you wouldn't. Yeah, so it's absolutely crucial that you've got to have religious differences, religious diversity if you want, or you've got to have this sectarian quality to religion before you're going to get an appreciation of this issue. Okay, but it's not just about religious differences. If it was just religious differences, you think one thing, I believe one thing, you believe a different thing, and so on. Everybody's got different beliefs. What do we need a First Amendment for? That's the next
question. Stop people from killing each other over religious differences.
There you go. Exactly. For to remove the use of force from the realm of religion. To remove that agency of force from the realm of religion. And that agency is the state. So what we need in our story of the Reformation and religious wars to get it right is something that tells us about the use of force in religion that was not properly understood. How dangerous, how terrible that is. And that, well, that's our bridge between the differences. These are the people responsible for the differences. But what about the use of force in religion? When did we see that? We've got one, a fact that really stands out in that regard that we need to have in order to get this period right. What happened? What about the violence in the Reformation? Go back to your facts. I think I might have to bring it up on screen for you guys if it's not coming to you. Anything in that? I'll put it on the screen and I'll let you find it. Okay. On this screen, okay, after 1517, we'll even make it easier on you, just the 1500s. Find me the fact that is crucial to this Reformation and religious wars. Timothy wins the race. Timothy.
Is it 1555?
Okay, why? Yeah. Why? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Why?
Because the Holy Roman Emperor is saying that he wants, well, he's signing this peace of offer saying, Quis edio et legio, which means he wants to control his, because, yeah, he wants to have his religion. Because he's the Holy Roman Emperor, he wants to have his religion everywhere in his empire.
Okay. And more than that, it's not necessarily that he wants Catholicism. It just means that the ruler chooses the religion. And that was going to mean, in the case of the Peace of Augsburg, also Lutheranism as a possible choice. But again, you don't have any rights in this particular environment. There are no rights to religion. There are rulers. And the ruler gets to decide the religion. Alexander, more on that?
Sorry, I forgot to put my hand down. I was going to say that it's the Peace of Augsburg, and where it's not religious toleration, it's religious forcing of people to accept your religion.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so now we're getting closer here. The principle of cuius regio eius religio. So once we have that in place, then we're getting closer. Now, this is still kind of a tricky proposition here. So we'll have to come back one more time, I think, tomorrow and decide what we're going to do about this here. But now that we've got this, we're ready to this is a crucial one. Maybe it's enough to get us to this principle of, okay, in America, we're going to get toleration and then we're going to get freedom. Okay. So Juliet, what's your thought?
I was just wondering, could the fact also be, when Martin Luther first argues with the Pope, because without him to start the religious wars, it couldn't have really started, I guess.
Well, yeah, but we've already pretty much got that. In 1517, by issuing the 95 Theses, he's beginning the argument with the Pope. So we've already got that. So Sorry. Just by stating his disagreement, that's already it. Yeah, that's exactly what 1517 is. And yeah, there were stages to that argument, but 1517 was the moment where it all began. So we've got it. Okay. So we've got sects, which means to say we have differences, and we have rulers imposing their particular preference in the matter of differences. And actually, we've already got another one that involves the use of force. Nobody spoke up. We already had one that involves the use of force. Which one is it? You guys didn't see that? Alexander?
I did see it, but I thought the other one was more important.
Fair enough.
Begins an argument with the Pope. It means he's arguing. And,
No, but which one are you saying is?
The Martin Luther.
No. That's not the one.
Okay.
Which one of these is directly the use of force? Not stating a personal disagreement. One of these is the use of force. You don't recognize it? Well, you got to learn to recognize the use of force. Timothy.
The formation of Anglicanism.
Yeah, why?
Because it was a king who created Anglicanism, Henry VIII, and the only reason he created it is so that he could get what he wanted in divorcing his wife.
Yeah, but now, but think more globally here. What is it? The words "acts of supremacy." Who is to be supreme in religion?
The king.
The king. That's just this by another name. The acts of supremacy is exactly the same thing. It just means cuius regio. And I'm Henry VIII, so I'm the regio. Okay, so this is definitely the conflict within European culture and America's. First of all, you got to get some toleration in here. So we'll get to that later, but then you get to the freedom part. If people understand rights as the founders did. Okay, good. All right, this is going back over this multiple times is. In class is kind of a new thing. I haven't always done so much with you guys in class in the past, but I want to do it because I'm sensing that it remains a little bit outside your comfort zone, or it's not something that you have command over yet. And so I want to emphasize the importance of it and not just go off and give you a writing assignment and have it kind of be something that you're doing without my guidance. I think that it's important to do it in class, give you a chance to think it through, talk it over, look at it again, ask questions, please, and, get straight on it. And then when I send you off during the break to write your writing assignment, then you'll be ready to do it. All right, last discussion on this will be tomorrow, prior to the break and prior to the writing assignment. All right, now what we need to get to today here in the founding era is George Washington as president and his most significant present-centric contribution. So in other words, if we look at a person like George Washington, there's just an enormous amount to learn about him. And so it's very hard to make specific choices. To put it another way, it's very easy to get wrapped up in lots of details about him. And then to kind of get swamped by those details. It's just one specific case of the general problem of the study of history is just the study of any particular individual in history. Even single people have a lot going on in their lives and do a lot of things. And again, we have the same question. What of the things that they did and said should we pay attention to in history? And as president, with Washington, as I say, there's so much, but we're going to start in the place that is the most significant of all. That's always our aim here at this level in which we're operating, where we're not in command of the story yet. We can't go deeper. We've got to start in the right place, and we've got to look for the thing that is the most significant of all. And it is not only true of Washington, but it's true of all of the founding fathers as president. So that really reinforces it. And it is, in fact, the essence of the founding era. So what is it? The essence is protecting Americans from the danger posed to their rights by the rest of the world. So the Bill of Rights protects Americans from their own government, but that was not the main threat. That was not the biggest danger to their rights. I mean, gosh, if you've got Thomas Jefferson as your president, you're not in much danger in terms of your rights. This is, you know, if you've got George Washington as your president, you're not going to be losing your rights. So at that point in time, certainly the American government was not going to be this force for denying you your rights. The most dangerous governments in the world were the other governments of the world, especially those governments of the most powerful countries, such as France and England. They might temporarily help you this day or that, but they didn't acknowledge individual rights. And so how was America to relate to these countries? That became the great challenge. Because you have this infant country. You have this kind of, it's like the United States is a new country. It's like a baby. And these other established countries have been around for hundreds of years. And they're very practiced in politics and the art of war. And they're going to try to take advantage of America, basically. And so Washington and the other founders had to devise a strategy for what America's relationship should be to the rest of the world in order to protect individual rights. And it was a very difficult question because immediately upon George Washington becoming president in 1789, France started to have a revolution. And this was very exciting because the people of France were moving in the direction of forming a republic. So imagine, here was America, it just become a republic itself. It was the first modern country to create a government without a king and to defend individual rights. And all of a sudden, one of the most powerful countries in the world, which had been its ally in the Revolutionary War, seems to be going in the same direction. How wonderful. It was really exciting. A lot of Americans believed that this was the dawn of this wonderful new age and that people would be free and that everything was going to be great. And so, you know, they wanted to help. The problem was that the rest of Europe had the opposite view of this. The rest of Europe was still being ruled by kings. And they looked at France and they really panicked. They said, if France gets rid of its king, well, who's next? So all the kings, all the rulers of Europe, every one of them, a Menes Narmer in his soul, felt threatened by the French Revolution. So, at a certain point, threats kind of passing back and forth between France and its neighbors, that led to war. And as George Washington's term as president is underway, France and England were at war. And so, of course, this was now going to be a very serious challenge. What was America's response? How would America act here? On the one hand, a lot of Americans, for instance, Thomas Jefferson was among them, were pro-France. They really were excited about the possibility that France would become a republic. On the other hand, a lot of Americans were pro-England. Even though, of course, they had become independent from their mother country, they still cherished it. They still felt the most kinship with British people. So they would rather support England. And a lot of them were suspicious of France. And that proved to be very, very prescient of them, very... It proved to be true that the French Revolution was not going to work out in a positive way. And so there was a big argument between the founding fathers over what to do. And one of the greatest accomplishments of Washington and one of his great character traits was his ability to listen to all the brilliant men around him, like Jefferson, arguing one side, and John Adams and others around him arguing other sides of this case, and coming up with the right answer. And what was Washington's answer? Well, if we keep in mind, and as we continue with the founding era in the next class when we return, if we keep in mind that the standard for the conduct of the American government during the founding era was individual rights, then we can understand what was Washington's great question. The question was, what mode of conduct by America with regard to foreign wars is protective of American rights? What's the best way to protect the rights of Americans when people in other countries are fighting wars? Now, I'm putting it in such a simple terms in order to make it accessible to you. It is going to end up being more subtle than this. But how do you protect Americans' rights when other people are fighting wars? Alexander?
You don't get in the war.
Yeah, you stay out. Exactly. Washington in 1793 proclaimed America's neutrality. You stay out of them. You know, you can't protect Americans' rights by sending them to die in other people's wars. And so I mean, that's the basic principle. Now, it's true. You might be thinking, what about, are there cases where that might not be true? I mean, it is possible for a country to go to war on behalf of an ally, if it's a genuine ally, in a manner that does defend its own citizens' rights. But this certainly was not the case. There was no outcome here where American citizens were going to have their rights better protected by getting involved in a war in Europe than by staying out. And this turned into a principled policy by Washington. This became his single most important piece of advice to the American people ever. In his farewell address, when Washington had been president for two terms, he delivered a speech, and this line here that I have highlighted from George Washington's speech was this: "The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible." And political connection, of course, also means military. You don't get one without the other. So, yes, old spelling, but let's focus on the meaning here. So, the great rule of conduct for America. These are in a way like the president's famous last words. What did he want to impart to the United States? We should stay out. And there's more. There's some really great passages here. Europe has a set of primary interests which have nothing to do with us. And so if we stay apart under an efficient government, There will come a time when nobody can touch us. And how amazing will that be for this nation to champion individual rights, protect its citizens, and essentially be untouchable by any enemy. That's what he's telling Americans to do. Stay out of other people's wars. And as I said, this is going to be the theme of the founding era. The other presidents to follow Washington agreed. Even if they disagreed about, oh, I like France versus England or what have you, they agreed with that concept. And we're going to see this repeated over the course of the founding era, that the most essential thing that they were doing as presidents was navigating through all of these dangers that were being presented to them by the rest of the world. The American government, okay, was making laws and acting in some ways not necessarily perfect and so on, but the key thing was that the most dangerous thing to the United States was other countries. And again, there would be no United States on the other end of this period had they not adopted this principle. We'll see. It's going to be over and over and over again. John Adams was the second president. Here he is. Second president in office, 1797 to 1801. And he was also embroiled in all kinds of conflicts because of the French Revolution. And so it's very hard for him to be president because France was collapsing. The French Revolution was going very badly. And during his presidency, the French Revolution completely collapsed. And who took over? In the year 1800. Who knows their European anchor facts? Alexander.
Napoleon.
Napoleon took over. Right, exactly. From bad to worse. Despite that, the United States did not get involved in the wars of the French Revolution or the Napoleonic Wars. And John Adams was so proud of this. Oops, I lost my place on the document. Excuse me for a sec while I go down to it. Oh, darn. I had it here and then I lost track of it. Let me just scroll down to it. Where is it? France. There we go. There's this whole passage on France. Oh, what a shame. I had it highlighted and then I lost it. Wait a minute. Let me see here. There we go. This. So what he had to do was, at all costs, as far as he could see, avoid war with France, which was doing so badly in its revolution. And when he was done, and when he looked back on his presidency, this is what he said. And it's quite an amazing thought. Looking back many years later, 15 years later, he said, "I desire no other inscription over my gravestone." So this is one of the founding fathers. This is a man who signed the Declaration of Independence. I mean, that's what I would want on my gravestone. I signed the Declaration of Independence. But what he wanted on his gravestone was, "Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of the peace with France." That's it. No foreign wars. As difficult as it was. And indeed, American ships had to defend themselves to some extent. So they ended up, historians look back on it and they call this period the Quasi-War. In other words, he was telling Americans, you can defend yourself, but we got to avoid getting into an official war because we can't really deal with it. We can't handle it. And that was true. America could not possibly contend with European superpowers at the time. So the next thing that John Adams did, and this is where we're going to end today, and his most important present-centric contribution to American history is fostering the growth of the American military. And so it was under his presidency that the United States Navy was established. And this one is, well, it's called the USS Constitution. And it's still a working vessel in the United States Navy today. This is a picture of it in Boston Harbor. And you can go see it. Unfortunately, they're renovating it now. So I don't think it's in the water anymore. You can't go on tours or whatever. I think they're fixing it. But it'll be back. But anyway, the crucial thing now under Adams was that recognizing that countries like France and England were dangerous, America had to be able to defend itself. America needed a military to defend its citizens' rights. And so sometimes John Adams is known as the father of the Navy. All right. We needed to get through Washington and Adams and their crucial conduct in the founding era. When we come back, like I said, after the break, we're going to look at Jefferson and Madison and finally James Monroe. And what we'll see there is more of the same. The essence of their conduct as presidents, their contribution to American history was this all-important idea of how America should relate to the rest of the world. How did an independent republic relate to the rest of the world? Stay out of foreign wars. Evidently, Americans stopped listening to them. At some point, Americans stopped listening to the Founding Fathers. Because, well, just look around. Americans die all over the world now fighting other people's wars. So, this is going to be one of the most interesting challenges in terms of understanding American history. And what it means for us today and into the future is, what did the founders have to say about this? What is America like today? And what do we make of it? All right, that'll do. Thank you, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.